This edition of The Review was first broadcast on the 9th of February 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House in London, with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Sophie Grove.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll shed some light on an international exhibition in London exploring a luminous medium.
We'll cross to New York to find out why this has been getting music industry aficionado Winston Ford up in the morning.
Explore the variety of new international TV shows, which are now just a mouse click away, with Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast Magazine.
President-elect Garrett Walker.
Do I like him? No. Do I believe in him? That's beside the point. Any politician that gets 70 million votes has tapped into something larger than himself, larger than even me, as much as I hate to admit it.
That was Kevin Spacey in House of Cards. Plus, we'll take a trip around the world to get some cultural listings for the coming days. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. That is the sound of light. Well, it's the sound of one of the works currently on display at London's Haywood Gallery. An exhibition has just opened there entitled Light Show, which, as the name suggests, brings together a range of international artworks that creatively explore light and our relationship with it.
The show, which is happening alongside a range of events examining light, darkness and everything in between, is a mixture of immersive installations and sculptures which shimmer, flash, illuminate and reveal.
Joining us now to, shed some light on the exhibition is Steve Gambardella, writer for theartsdesk.com. Steve, welcome to The Review.
Hi there, it's a pleasure to be here.
This is quite a show, isn't it? Because it's not just about light itself, but it's about, you know, what light tells us about the world around us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it's not really about light per se. It's not really a widespread coverage of artists using light, but actually something more profound than that. It's how artists have actually used light to create an environment around us, to dazzle us, to make us unsure of our step, to really have a physiological effect on us and to create the environment around us. And I think that's really the strength of this show.
I have to say, it did have a quite profound effect on us. It's very immersive. I mean, some of the works really just kind of draw you in, and you could probably spend just hours just floating around the show. Yeah. It is a show. It does have that sense of razzle-dazzle, kind of performative, fun. But it also is quite studious. It has a sense of, you know, a survey of light artists today. It has Dan Flavin and it has some new emerging artists. Do you think that it really does the medium justice in that sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we have here is something that's striking for its omissions. There's no sign of Tracy Emin or anything like that, who we well know uses light. Actually, at the core of this show is that really radical shift from in that moment in the 1960s when artists actually started to think about the environment. They stopped using artsy materials like canvas and bronze and began to use industrial materials. And the light really embodies that shift. Lots of contemporary artists, but yeah, as you mentioned, Dan Flavin's also in there, and he's the kind of father of this.
And yet, actually, you know, Dan Flavin's piece is quite, I mean, you know, blink and you'll miss it. It's sort of up against a wall in a kind of, as you go around a corner and it's, you know, it's just one, two, and then three luminous tubes, white luminous tubes.
Yeah.
Compare that to, you know, some of the other pieces like, you know, Carlos Cruz Diaz's incredibly immersive, you know, rooms of pink and green and blue.
And what a spectacular effect those rooms have on you. And that's really the story here, is that Dan Flavin's here. He hasn't been given a central place in the show, but his influence is so profound on these artists, and they really extrapolate the kind of themes that Dan Flavin, you know, was investigating in the early 1960s. And those rooms, you know, they have a profound effect on you as you walk through them, as you sit down, as you mooch about. It's, you know, it's a wonderful show.
I wondered what you thought of the actual lights themselves, because I felt that there was such a different interaction between some of the sodium lights and the filaments. We were kind of actually sort of just really drawn to the Kerith Wynne Adams and these amazing sort of, they were actually warm sort of pillars of light that kind of ebbed and flowed and sort of breathed. Then some of the LED lights were a bit sort of, I don't know, cold in comparison to that.
Silent
and I wondered if you think that artists are sort of playing with some of those different mediums and whether or not they're moving towards the LED, which is so much more eco-friendly, as you say.
Yeah, I think the show really, I mean, coming back to Dan Flavin, is it the core here is about materiality. It's about, you know, your physiological response to this stuff. And one of the, what's wonderful about that piece is that in only a few steps, you're suddenly really aware of the physicality of it. And I think the show oscillates between the very concrete things, the very physical things, and also light as something that's, you know, substanceless. And I think that piece that perfectly exemplifies that.
And certainly towards the end of the exhibition, when you get upstairs, you've got three pieces in particular which are a bit more disorientating, that have a bit more of a serious message to them, whether that's you know, Ivan Navarro's reality box, which is sort of weird foam box like structure. You go inside and there's mirrors, but you can't. You look up and you look down, and it sort of goes on for infinity, which is a sort of, you know, for him coming from Chile at a time of General Pinochet. Then you've got Jenny Holzer's monument, which is astonishing sort of LED screens with the dullest pieces of writing from, you know, declassified war on terror documents. There's this real sense of issues of torture and trying to sort of, you know, not quite feel like you're comfortable there.
Yeah, I think this is the key, really. I think this is what really pushes the show over the edge into something quite spectacular. And as you mentioned earlier, scholarly, very sound, is that power plays a role here. And the reality box, as Navarro calls it, is a wonderful inclusion, because with disorientation at the heart of this show, of perceptual disorientation, the reality box reminds us of how those techniques are used in torture. And Holzer as well, you know, you're left swimming in this sea of information, light generated information, and, you know, really it has, you know, excuse the pun, but a kind of dark edge to the show, which I think is great.
It's interesting that they've chosen to do this show at this time of year. I mean, it's kind of traditional in a way to do light shows, you know, in the darkest months. You have the Fête de Lumière and in Lyon, and you have even Diwali in November. It's kind of, there's something almost sort of medicinal about this. You know, you need, when you're there, you feel very drawn to the artworks. Do you think that's kind of a strategical decision on their part, and whether or not it shows the kind of power of light as a medium in art?
I think it's a nice thought. I never actually considered that. But I do, yeah. I mean, there's something very spectacular and wonderful about walking into that gallery. And, you know, the Hayward Gallery is a very difficult space to fill. It's very cavernous. A lot of shows have done badly there because, you know, it's a bit overwhelming. But the light really fills the space, especially Wynne Evans's work. It just fills up the space. It pulsates. It radiates. You know, you really feel that as you walk into the gallery. It feels wonderful.
It's a difficult show to curate in a sense, really, isn't it? Because you can't just think about how one piece responds to the one you've just seen, but also where you're going to put it so that it doesn't, you know, one doesn't bleed into the other.
Absolutely. It must have been incredibly hard to curate. It's that, you know, these artists, they're using the environment. Some of those works are quite muscular in the way that they really spread themselves. So it must have been quite tricky. But I think they did a great job.
Do you think that there were any omissions that, you know, were regrettable? I mean, Bruce Nauman wasn't there. He's got a show on at Howes and Worth.
Yes,
so
yes.
He's got some presence in London. But I wondered whether or not there were some people that, you know, were part of this sort of canon that maybe should have been included.
Yeah, some of the omissions I actually thought made the show actually better. You know, I was expecting Tim Noble and Sue Webster. I was expecting Tracy Emin. But, it turned out that this was a wonderfully international show. It wasn't so British-centric. It wasn't feeding off trends. Nauman wasn't there, which was regrettable, but he's at Howes and Worth with that wonderful light installation, and I guess it's one of those things. It's curatorially, some things just don't work out.
You mentioned the international aspect, of the show. I mean, looking at the pieces that are there, I mean, do you see major differences between the way artists from different countries are approaching the whole usage of light?
Yeah, I think there is that kind of curious aspect to it. I think the British stuff on show is quite intellectual and maybe a little bit academic. I think the Latin Americans are more concerned with a very kind of almost visceral effect on your body with the way you move into their environments. So yeah, certainly there's quite profound differences.
We should probably mention Olafur Eliasson. His crazy installation, which uses strobe lights and water. It's very showy and it's very affecting. I mean, you know, some people couldn't even stand it for like seconds, and we had to close our eyes in there because it was so intense. I wonder whether you felt that there was meaning to that, or is that really kind of too theme park?
I think it kind of made me nauseous standing in there for too long. It's you know, the strobe lighting effect reminded me of my early 20s, and
it's a bit Bergheim, wasn't it?
Yeah. But I thought it was a wonderful work. I thought it was very pretty, the way that, you know, water was literally crystallised in midair. It had a sensational effect. But, you know, it left me thinking it's a bit too much, perhaps.
It was funny, actually, as Sophie says, when we went in there, we closed our eyes at one stage. Yeah. And when you close your eyes and you don't have that strobe going off, it's incredibly calm. And it sounds like you're just by a stream.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. And then you open your eyes again, and suddenly you're just assaulted by this strobe.
Yeah.
And the water you can see is, as you say, it looks like it's crystallized and it's like ice. It's a really bizarre sort of effect to do that.
Yeah.
When you look back over, when you got to the end, you got to the Eliasson, and that was that. What were the bits you were like, oh, you know what, I'm just going to go back to that room one last time. That was the one I felt safe. Well, that was when I feel like I want to sort of immerse myself in again.
I was just transfixed and, you know, bowled over by Navarro. I thought I was really lucky in, you know, when you're a critic, you actually get access to these exhibitions and you can kind of walk around on your own. It's a shame because I imagine that it's quite a crowded exhibition and that may well be an issue. But the Navarro's piece, just that kind of Doctor Who sci-fi TARDIS sinister, it was, you know, I was just completely transfixed by that one.
And it's an interesting use of sort of kinetic sort of movement in the show, kind of a homage to the Moholy Nagy kind of Bauhaus revolving sculpture everyone's really familiar with. I wondered, did you think that worked in this context, or do you think that, you know, maybe took away from the light aspect of the show?
No, I thought it was lovely. As I mentioned earlier, I don't think it was about light per se, but actually, you know, the way light's used as a medium to have particular effects on people. And this stuff is really heavily influenced by early constructivism and, you know, kind of things like that, where the environment's really taken over, you know, the use of industrial materials and indeed movement. It's just really it really brings out that kind of radical break that took place during the 1960s in Western art, and it was great.
Steve Gambardella, we're going to have to, I'm afraid, leave it there. We didn't even mention Jim Campbell's Exploded View, which was beautiful. We didn't mention Comrade Shawcross with his wonderful sort of slow arc thing, with sort of, which really reminded me of being in the Alhambra, oddly. It was a very sort of mathematical, Moorish thing to it. Lots of amazing things. Do go and see it if you're in London. If you're not in London, come to London just to see that. It's wonderful. It's a light show at the Hayward Gallery. Steve Gambardella, writer for theartsdesk.com, thank you very much for joining us on The Review. Next up, we'll be taking a cultural trip around the world. Stay tuned.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalising the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove, and Steve Bloomfield. Time to cross to our associate editor, Nelly Godchifer, now to hear some cultural treats she's dug out from around the world for us this weekend.
This weekend in Florence, step into an exhibition dedicated to Salvador Dali. Palazzo Medici Riccardi welcomes a collection of Dali's lesser-known works, including surrealist furniture, bronze and glass sculptures, plus illustrations depicting sensual scenes from novels by the likes of Dante and Boccaccio. Featuring over 100 works, the exhibit is in Florence until the 25th of May. Hitting cinemas across Europe this weekend is No, by Chilean director Pablo Larraín. It completes the trilogy about the 17-year dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet and features Gael Garcia Bernal as publicist René Saavedra, who helped develop the No campaign against Pinochet's dictatorship. The film is also Chile's official entry for Best Foreign Language Film at this year's Oscars. No is now out at cinemas across the UK, Spain and Norway, and in the US on the 15th of February. This weekend, a vault near Waterloo Station in London welcomed the work of Central St. Martin's graduate David Brower Vile. Entitled Project 4, the show features 70 large-format paintings and a handful of sculptures by the post-impressionist artist. The show is on until the 1st of March. Japan's long love affair with all things Nordic comes to a culmination this weekend with a festival celebrating Scandinavian film, music and art. The week-long Northern Lights Festival runs until the 15th of February. We recommend Swedish-French dramedy Sound of Noise, directed by Ole Simonsen and Johannes Nilsson, and a Norwegian offering by Ole Andersen, King Curling. For more details, visit tnlf.jp. And our music choice this weekend is the latest Fred Deacon LP entitled Frank Eddie. Expect soulful electronic beats with an urban edge. Let's hear Body Call. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Godchifer. Baby, no more stalling. These days I've been longing to touch you, baby. Now that you've come around to see it in my way, you won't regret it, baby. And you surely won't forget it, baby. It's unbelievable how the body.
And that was a Body Call from Fred Deacon. Although I did, I must say, read that on the script originally as Booty Call.
A confession.
That was from Fred Deacon, Body Call. Fred, of course, was last week's music reviewer, and he was ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva. Fred's new LP, Frank Eddie, is out right now.
You're listening to The Review with me, Sophie Grove, and Steve Bloomfield, where it's time now for our weekly music guest. Joining us on the line from New York is Winston Ford, known to one and all as Stone.
Stone is CEO of the Couch Sessions music blog and the Couch Sessions Next creative agency, an expert in brand marketing, at music consulting, and, you know, generally navigating the world of bands and brands. Stone, welcome to Monocle 24.
Hello, hello. Good morning or good afternoon to you guys.
Well, yes, good morning from New York. Thank you very much for getting up so early on a Saturday morning. We very much appreciate it. Now, you do a lot of work with, tying up sort of brands and bands. How does that work now? I mean, because obviously we've moved on quite a new direction over the last 10 years, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, brands are now realizing that a lot of people are not going to the traditional marketing channels like TV and radio. So in order for them to kind of appeal to younger demographics, they're using music and doing these festivals and staging concerts all across the world to kind of like engage younger consumers. And they're trying to use cool, hip bands to kind of make them look cool as well. So that's where I kind of come in to make that happen.
And I wonder, Stone, I mean, we've seen the music industry changing so much and financially changing too. Do you think this might be the saviour, really, in terms of an economic model for music?
You know, for a lot of groups, it is. I mean, there's a lot of labels now that are actually run by brands, and they're giving artists, they're signing artists that probably would not have been signed by some of the traditional major labels. So I feel like it's providing a lot of capital for a lot of artists that probably would not have that opportunity just in the traditional marketplace.
Stone, there'll be a lot of people listening who will be, you know, to be honest, distinctly uncomfortable about the closer links between bands and brands. It's one thing to say, you know, have someone sponsor your tour or work with your merchandise and so on, but when they're closely involved in the creation of the music and there are, you know, key mentions of a certain brand within a song, are there issues over artistic integrity that you struggle with here?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been lucky in the projects that I've worked with. A lot of the brands that I work with kind of understand and kind of take a step back. But what a lot of brands are realizing as well is that it's authenticity that really sells. So if you have somebody, you know, kind of shilling for your product and making a jingle, it won't go over well with the fans. And, you know, in the age of social media now, there'll be a backlash against the brand and the artist. So I think that the right brands are kind of very aware of that, and they're kind of tailoring their marketing towards that. And, you know, the brands who are not are going to fail, and they'll learn from their mistakes, hopefully. But
I wonder what brands are really doing this well, and what type of brands we're looking at. I mean, is it mainly alcohol and fashion, or are other sectors kind of getting in on the act here?
Well, I think the brands that are doing really well, you know, are the youth-oriented brands that kind of have the ear to the marketplace. And there's a car company in America called Scion that has done really well with getting, you know, cutting-edge artists and giving them a platform and kind of paying for their album releases, paying for their videos and things like that, or paying for different events. And there's this Green Label Sound, which is actually it's run by a American cola brand, but it has launched the careers of Theophilus London and Chromeo and, you know, Star Slinger and other artists. So there are definitely brands that are getting it right in terms of marketing, but I think those brands are already kind of youth-focused anyway. There's some brands, which I won't mention, there are probably a lot of old men in a room that are trying to look cool. And like
exactly. Okay, well, yeah. Stone, you've chosen a few tracks for us to play this morning. We're going to play the first, and then we'll have a chat about it and why you've chosen it. This first one is Fiona Apple and Every Single Night.
And that was the Mellow X mix of Fiona Apple's Every Single Night. Now, Stone, tell us why you like this remix so much.
I love remixes. And I kind of like that remix because it takes a Fiona Apple song that is kind of a Fiona Apple song, and it adds these tribal drums to the background and makes it this kind of tribal dance track and completely kind of flips the whole atmosphere of the track. And when it comes to remixes, I love a remix that kind of completely does something different with the original source material.
Yeah, it really does. We've got another remix, which I hope we're going to be able to find time with at the end. But there's another couple of tracks first. One of which is, let's be honest, you're pushing one of your friends here, but your friend is rather good. You can talk about why you like this track so much after this. This is Maris and Rashida Jones.
That was Rashida Jones there with Maris, and she's from Kansas, with a genre you're calling Goomba Wave. Can you tell us about that?
Well, actually, Maris is the producer, and Rashida Jones is the track. Essentially, it's Goomba Wave or Future Trap is kind of taking these Southern hip hop beats, these what they call 808s, and kind of putting them against kind of like trip hop or lounge music, and creating this kind of like atmospheric hip hop mashup. And I think Clance Casino is a producer out of America, made it kind of popular. It's kind of seeping through. And Maris is a guy from Middle America. He's from Kansas, and he's kind of popularizing the sound. And it works. We booked him at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, and he just completely tore down the whole floor with this track, because it's slow enough to dance to, but it's energetic enough to kind of make it not really a slow song, if that makes any sense.
Do you think that these sorts of different trends in hip hop are helping to take it in a new direction that it perhaps wouldn't have been expected maybe 5 years ago?
Yeah, definitely. You now have a lot of hip hop guys who are sampling indie rock tracks and doing collaborations with indie rock artists, and kind of this the internet's made it easy for producers from, say, Finland or Australia to work on tracks for American hip hop artists. So it's kind of opened the door to what people think of traditional hip hop now. The internet has really kind of broken a lot of boundaries musically and culturally in that regard, for sure.
Okay, let's have your third track now. Again, we'll talk about it afterwards. This is Cherub with Man of the Hour.
The man of the hour never sleeps, but
And that was Cherub with Man of the Hour, and they're an electropop duo from Nashville. We can hear some influences there, a little bit of MGMT. Can you tell us a bit more about Cherub?
They actually came on my radar towards the end of this year. My business partner was like, hey, you got to check out this band. And I was like, okay, cool. And it's definitely an MGMT passion pit kind of influenced sound, but it's a bit more soulful. And some of their other tracks are a little bit more hip-hop influenced. And the fact that they're from Nashville, Tennessee, which is like the home of country music, kind of like struck me, it's just a track that I've just been playing on my iPhone on repeat for the past 3 or 4 months.
It's got inside your head.
I can't tell you why, but it's just such an amazing track to me.
But that's often the way, isn't it? That you don't know exactly why, but it just sticks with you.
Yeah, those are the best tracks, you know.
Now let's go on to a track which has stuck in your head, perhaps for the wrong reason, but this remix perhaps gives it a new lease of life. All of us have had Gautier in our heads for a good year or so. But this M-Phase remix that we're going to play now of Somebody That I Used to Know, what is it that you think makes this makes it worthwhile bringing this to our attention once again?
Well, you know, it's funny. Yeah, I was the same way. You know, I was just really sick of this song, and I heard this M-Phase's remix, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. It sounds like a completely different song. And the funny thing, the backstory about the track is M-Phase was sick of the song as well. And he's like, and he's sick of all the remixes. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to make my own. And he made this kind of really laid back, down tempo remix that is really sweet and really, really like amazing for, again, I'm speechless, but and I just like the fact that it made the song enjoyable again for a lot of people. So it's my top remix of 2012 for sure.
Excellent. Well, I think that would be a good place to leave it. Winston Ford at Stone, CEO of Triple Star Media Group, founder of The Couch Sessions, thank you very much for joining us on The Review. This is Gautier featuring Kimbra, the M-Phases remix of Somebody That I Used to Know. That was Gautier featuring Kimbra, Somebody That I Used to Know, the M-Phases remix. Sophie, a fan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I've heard enough of that song, possibly.
I think that's the problem, actually, isn't it? If it hadn't been such a huge, huge, huge hit, you'd be like, oh, I really like this.
But, and here it is again. Well, staying in the Big Apple now, it's time to hear from Barrett Austin from our New York Bureau about what's coming up there over the coming days.
With the annual celebration of Mardi Gras coming up on Tuesday, it seems fitting that we drop by and listen to New Orleans jazz legend Kermit Ruffins, who will be playing Saturday evening at Le Poisson Rouge in Manhattan. The talented Crescent City trumpeter will be joined on stage with the ever-skilled barbecue swingers for a rare New York performance. The traditional Southern Jazz Quintet takes to the stage at 8:30 for a big night of New Orleans boogie music. This weekend also marks the release of The Man Who Died in His Boat by Portland-based Grouper, known also as Liz Harris. Grouper's emotive new album represents a bold follow-up to her breakthrough release, inventively titled Dragging a Dead Deer Up a Hill. All strange titles aside, it's just the sort of music to keep you cozy on a snowy New York weekend. And Lincoln Center plays host to Symphonic Balanchine, featuring three of the esteemed choreographer's ballets. The performance begins with a glimpse of Balanchine's Western Symphony, moves forward with Symphony in three movements, and offers a dramatic close with Symphony in C. If the idea of a Stravinsky score and graceful ballerinas made up in Swarovski tutus seems of interest, this might be your ticket. If it's a film you're after, this weekend also marks the opening of Steven Soderbergh's Side Effects, starring Rudy Mara, Jude Law, and Channing Tatum. The chilling thriller tells the story of a New York couple whose lives take a dramatic turn after Mara's character begins to experience unusual side effects while prescribed Ablixa, a terrifying new drug meant to treat her anxiety. Suspenseful twists and turns are sure to leave you on the edge of your seat.
911, what's your emergency?
I need help! Someone's been murdered!
There's also plenty of art to be seen this weekend, including a new show of Basquiat at Gagosian's Chelsea Space, as well as new works from New York-based contemporary painter Aaron Bobrow, now on view at Andrea Rosen Gallery. For Monocle, in New York, I'm Barrett Austin.
I think that's the favourite thing of Barrett's that he does each week. I think it's without doubt the thing he loves the most.
I hope he gets a chance to see all those himself.
He does. I think that's all he does all the time. That was Barrett Austin in New York. Thank you very much for that, Barrett. You're listening to Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this to hear what international TV is worth watching and also how we're actually going to be watching it.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here. And you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Sophie Grove, and Steve Bloomfield.
We end the show today with a spot of TV, and I'm delighted to welcome back regular Review contributor Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast Magazine, to fill us in on some of the TV shows that have caught her attention. Lisa, welcome back to The Review.
Hello.
Now we're going to start with something very old, which is it very old? It was this morning we were talking about it, I realised it was 23 years ago that House of Cards.
That's right, yeah.
Which makes us all feel rather old. We're going to talk about House of Cards, but it's a remake. And it's a remake in America with Kevin Spacey. Now, House of Cards was a political drama. It was like the pre-West Wing thriller, certainly in the UK in the 90s. The fact that it's been remade is one thing, but it's also, Lisa, interesting how it's been remade and where you can watch it.
Yeah, I think this is fascinating and groundbreaking on so many levels. So firstly, it's costing $100 million for 26 episodes. That's two series.
How does that compare? Sorry, just on that, how does that compare normally to things? I mean, that strikes me as incredibly expensive.
It's enormously expensive, yeah. I mean, British drama tends to be £1 million per hour is the real top-end, high-end drama. And this is the most expensive online series to date. It's also the most star-studded, as you say, with Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright, directed by David Fincher, so, you know, Fight Club 7, Social Network. But its distribution is fascinating, and it's prompted widespread debate around this because it could prove a turning point in the way TV is not only consumed but also produced. Talk a bit more about that later. This is an updated version, and I think the reason that they've done it is there's always a huge appetite for political stories. I mean, it's really fertile ground, and we've seen things like, you know, West Wing, Borgen, Veep, all kinds of series just, you know, doing really well. So this is an Americanized version of this British series, as you say, and it's updated. So we're in 2013. So there's lots of stuff around the interplay of politics and the media and social media and blogging and everything else. So,
but that key thing is, as we've alluded to there, is that it's online. This is not HBO. This is Netflix. And Netflix have spent $100 million on this, put it online, and you can watch it all in one go.
That's right. And so, yes, it's 13 episodes released all in one go, which, you know, is really a first. And it was released in North America, Latin America, Scandinavia, the UK and Ireland, all on the same day, all last Friday. It's really interesting on many levels because one of the problems that the broadcasters have been battling with is piracy. So it, you know, kills that dead in one blow. And it's also really, you know, tapping into these changing consumption habits, because why should we wait now? You know, why should we wait a week for what we really love? It just seems, you know, old fashioned at best, and actually very frustrating for viewers at the worst. So I think there's been a lot of fear from the traditional broadcasters about these new players like Netflix and Amazon and Love Film about, you know, how they're going to sort of upset the apple cart. So it really is quite fascinating to see how it play out.
Do you think Netflix is trying to sort of emulate almost the box set culture? Because people quite like, you know, really just binging on their series now, kind of almost storing things up.
Yeah.
And then just, you know, sort of having a weekend in and watching the whole thing.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's kind of doing that, but slightly differently.
That's exactly what it's doing. I mean, I think that is a real trend that they're tapping into, and they're tapping into it first in a bigger and better way than anybody else. And it's interesting looking at the people who have actually streamed this. They're being very vague about the numbers, but to be honest, they're not really in a numbers game. You know, it's a huge marketing exercise for them. It's about getting new subscribers. It's about avoiding churn. And really having a bigger impact in other territories, because it is quite big in the States. So, but it's interesting because a third of the people who viewed it watched it in an entire weekend. They just sat there and watched this back to back, which is pretty amazing.
Wow,
but
yeah.
I mean, I've got a number of concerns about it. One is this. We've all watched some of it around this table. We can't talk about it, though, because I've got no idea, Lisa, where you've got up to. And there's a real danger that I might say, oh, have you seen that bit where... And they go, oh, no, I haven't seen that. You've ruined it for me. So this whole idea of, you know, talking about things we've
watched. The water cooler moment, I agree, I think that is a bit of an issue. And, you know, everyone's waiting for everyone to catch up and then you can really go for it. So, and you kind of have to avoid Twitter and things in the meantime. But then having said that, there is still a real buzz around it. So it's, you know, it's sort of working. We can't talk about it, yet everyone is, really bizarrely.
It's funny because, I mean... In a way, terrestrial TV has that strange... I'm a bit of a Luddite in that way. I just love having to wait for things. And then, even this week, then this Polyakov drama was on British TV. People were like, oh, you know, have you seen it? And there's this kind of struggle around seeing it and a sense of togetherness when you're watching it and then talking about it in the office. Do you think that might just... You know, be a thing of the past culturally, kind of, in, you know, if this really does kick off like you think it might?
Well, yeah, I think it's about convenience and it's about delivering people, you know, what they want when they want it, sort of anytime, anywhere viewing. You know, you can imagine a scenario in the future where people just stream what they want to whatever device they want and wherever they are. And, you know, you hear anecdotally lots of people want to watch, you know, they'll watch a box set at the weekend or when they go on holiday or something like that. It is really a changing pattern of consumption, and Netflix have just got right in there and capitalising on it. And I think it's going to be a real challenge for the other broadcasters. But, you know, it's a big and exciting series. And what's also interesting is the way it's produced, because normally you would have a pilot, you would then potentially, that pilot would never see the light of day. I mean, hundreds and hundreds are made every year. They've said, forget the pilot, we're going not only straight to series, we're going straight to two series. And, you know, to get names like Kevin Spacey and David Fincher, who have been approached about TV for years and years and have said no, they have said yes this time because of the budget and because of the freedom. So there aren't any channel execs breathing down their necks, giving them notes, you know, at the end of every episode. So this, you know, is so attractive. So this is a real challenge for the other broadcasters, because why wouldn't the big name talent want to work in this way?
And now, as you said, it is a remake, and we can talk in a moment about whether it stacks up to the original. But first, we should probably hear a little bit of it. This is the new House of Cards.
Take a step back. Look at the bigger picture. That's how you devour a whale, one bite at a time. Give and take. Welcome to Washington.
Now, thankfully, that was Kevin Spacey. Thankfully, we didn't have a clip of him saying the famous Francis Urquhart line. You may think that, I couldn't possibly comment. although he does say it, and he does it well. How does Kevin Spacey compare to the great late Ian Richardson?
I think he does a great job, actually. I think what's interesting is that the one element that they've retained from the original is, you know, breaking the fourth wall, looking straight to the viewer, straight to camera. And it's a tricky one to pull off. I mean, you know, done badly, it's appalling.
But this way you feel like he sort of draws you into his side because he's a nasty character and you feel like you're on his side because he's sort of giving little asides to you. Like, oh yeah, go on, Francis, you can do it.
Yeah, we are the co-conspirators, aren't we? And we're, you know, and he trusts us and we love to be in this position of trust and, you know, even more than his wife who is equally nasty, isn't she? And I think it's, it really, really does pull you in. It's done well. It's very sort of Shakespearean, and in fact Kevin Spacey has been playing Richard III recently in the Sam Mendes production, and I think, you know, he's drawing
channels
on that.
That, yeah.
Yes, yeah. But he's just, you know, he's joyfully manipulative, isn't he? He's just, you know, this political savvy and cunning and sheer guts that he can dispose of anyone that gets in his way, and he is so motivated by revenge. I mean, to sort of, you know, give a bit of the backstory, he essentially helped the president get where he was and was expecting to become a Secretary of State in return. But, you know, he's not just stabbed in the back, he's stabbed in the chest. He doesn't get the job. And then he's, you know, filled with revenge, and he is so determined to just, you know, get rid of everybody. And it's fascinating to see how he can kind of keep them on side at the same time.
I wonder how this will play out to North American audiences, because they are so used to having this positive spin on their White House and their politics with the West Wing. And even I remember a British politician, Jackie Smith, saying, we need a British Borg, and we don't want to be ridiculed as politicians. We need something that lifts us up and makes us look good. And this is so negative and Machiavellian. I wondered, you know, will they actually respond to that, or might they just want to go back to the West Wing?
I don't know. Well, I mean, it's the antithesis of the West Wing, isn't it? But it's hugely entertaining to watch these really evil characters, to be honest. And it's I think it's quite refreshing to see that. And I do think audiences want something a bit different, and it is providing that. I think it's just time for you know, a different technological way of viewing and a different approach to, you know, a standard political story.
Well, let's look at what Netflix may do in the future, because, I mean, yeah, this essentially announces them as a big player, as in a sense, you know, this decade's version of HBO. Do you expect them to be doing more projects like this in the future?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is, you know, I used to subscribe to Netflix but for a couple of months, because a lot of the content is old. You know, it's this sort of at least a year old, and someone like Sky has got all the exclusive rights with the Hollywood studios. So what this does, they're going to be picking, putting money into the odd massive series, and will just do enough to keep you ticking over on your subscription on a monthly basis. So they've got Arrested Development coming up, which was a cult hit a few years ago on Fox, and people were so, you know, it's won Emmys and Globes and everything, and people were so upset when that was cancelled. So that's coming back. There's a horror drama. There's something by the writer of Weeds called Orange is the New Black, and that's all about, it's set in a women's prison.
Excellent. Good.
Always a winner.
But what I think is really interesting is when, you know, you get to the end of an episode and the little, you know, timer comes on, you know, 14 seconds till the next episode starts, and it starts ticking down, and it's so compelling, isn't it? You see that arrow and you're like, oh, look, I'm going to click on it.
Click.
And, you know, they don't leave those cliffhangers either, because there isn't this sort of sense of false jeopardy. I think what I love about the series is these sort of lingering moments and huge silences, and it's not all sort of bang, 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 pacey and leaving you on the edge with a big cliffhanger. They don't need to do that. They know you've subscribed, and you are going to go to the next series, to the next episode quite easily. So I think it gives a bit of breathing space, and it feels quite different from the other sort of 24 style dramas that are around.
It'll be really interesting to see whether it changes the way others do it as well. I must say, if there is going to be a women's prison drama, I don't see why they don't just do a remake of Prisoner Cell Block H. I mean, it's got potential. It really has.
Yes.
You're not convinced by that?
I'm not sure you've got a job as a commissioner necessarily.
Really? Oh, come on. That was classic
TV. That's a damning verdict.
Classic TV. Very quickly, in the last 20 seconds, tell us, Lisa, will you be watching to the very, very end of House of Cards?
I will, definitely.
Yeah?
Yep.
Okay, your West Wing box set isn't sort of winking at you in a corner.
I'll probably go back to that as well, actually.
Okay, good. And then there's the House of Cards box set as well. Actually, yes, look, if you're going to watch this on Netflix, Netflix, then do try and dig out House of Cards on DVD. The BBC, I'm sure, have done it. If they haven't, they really should. Lisa Campbell from Broadcast Magazine, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Review. That pretty much brings us to the end of today's show. It's going to be goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show was produced by Case Bilboa. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Studio manager was Toby Hammond, and special thanks also to Ben Briseño. The Review will be back next Saturday with Marcus Hippie and Phil Hahn. But if you can't wait that long for your next slice of culture, here's what Rob's Culture Show has to offer at 1900 Hours on Monday.
On the latest edition, we host country rock legend Steve Earle. Head to Berlin and Burma for art and books, and via Mark Wallinger's new works for the London Underground, check out the new music scene in Egypt.
We're handing back over to Georgina now with the weekend edition. She'll have the curator. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly. That's tomorrow at midday. You've been listening to The Review with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Sophie Grove. Thank you very much for being here. Goodbye.